The following workshop was recorded at the 7th Annual Pittsburgh Classical Christian Education Conference. For more information about the conference, visit the Blackburn Study Center website at www.blackburnstudycenter.org.
Is there anybody that's here that wasn't in the earlier session, in the plenary session? Okay, because some of the things I'm going to be doing is building on that a little bit in this talk. This talk is transitioning from the grammar stage to the dialectic stage, and I want to talk a little bit about that process. This is a new talk for me. It's not something I haven't given a whole lot of thought to, but there's a big difference between thinking about something and talking about it privately than really trying to communicate it. And so there are a number of areas that I'm sure my thinking will refine in speaking about this if I do it a few more times. But I wanted to alert you to that because it's something that thinking out loud about it is something you might have some really good thoughts, and there'll be some time for Q&A toward the end of this session that we can participate in. One point of housekeeping. David, what is the close time for this? David, when is this over, to be over, to stay on schedule? 11:10. Okay, so we've got an hour. I will probably speak for half an hour or so be prepared with questions. If something hits you, please write it down. If you're anything like me, you'll forget it if you don't. One other thing, my wife was kind enough to remind me that I'm not going to be 50 next year, I'm going to be 50 this year. I mentioned in the last talk about our experience with memorizing the catechism, the idea that there was a peak going on in the fifth grade, sixth grade time frame with memorization. And I think that it's true to say that consistent with that experience was when students were really starting to move solidly into the dialectic stage. And this is an important transition because there's an enormous difference between just drinking stuff in and starting to wrestle with it and argue about it. And we're focusing on this transition only, as opposed to both transitions, grammar to dialectic and dialectic to rhetoric, for a reason that might be obvious to you, but I do want to point it out. And if you haven't thought about it, do think about this, and that is that the transition from the dialectic stage to the rhetoric stage is not nearly as meaningful, not nearly as precise and as different. I used some superlatives and some extreme examples to make a point, but the real fact of the matter is they don't one day quit being argumentative and start caring about how they're perceived by you. They still argue at 18 and at 20, and maybe beyond that we'll have to wait and see. But they do it less so. In other words, the dialectic and rhetoric tend to be a little bit more connected and hand in hand, where grammar and dialectic are not nearly as much. Another thing that we is a reason that we focus on it is because dialectic learning and learning in the context of the rhetoric stage is very different than grammar school learning. Dialectic learning is not just soaking it up. Grammar school learning, it's kind of teacher teaches, student absorbs. But the teaching process necessarily involves feedback from the student. In other words, there are some times where the student learns more by talking than by listening. And I'm not suggesting that they've become teachers in that process because they're talking, but rather that because they're interacting, they're learning. As they say something, they'll realize, if they've learned the fallacies already, that they've just created a fallacy. Or another student will point it out and they'll say, yeah, you're right, I hadn't thought about it that way, and make adjustments in their understanding and that sort of thing. So that's an important part of the process and a major distinction between the grammar stage and the dialectic stage. The other thing that's also important here in the transitioning understanding is that we're really not talking about airtight compartments. Remember I said, fifth grade, it kind of seems to peak, and maybe sixth grade, and it kind of goes down. If you think in some wooden way that someday, maybe July 16th of the summer between sixth grade and seventh grade, your child or the students that you teach are going to leave the grammar stage and enter the dialectic stage, you've really misunderstood the enormous complexity of the human being. It doesn't work that way. It's an enormous transition, and that's why we're contending with it for this hour. The other thing that I think is an important part of that, and this is something that we're learning from our mistakes in at Veritas Academy, is the idea of looking back, building connections with review. If you're familiar with the Veritas Press curriculum, which interestingly enough is used pretty significantly at Veritas Academy, you know a little about the history and Bible curriculum and the memorization and a student that has completed all 5 years of history and of Bible should have down cold 160 events in sequence in history and 160 in Bible and be able to connect those pretty well. But one of the things that we're still figuring out how to do is to keep the students that have learned that current with that information so that when they pick up Herodotus, even as early as 7th grade, and start reading about the beginning dominance of Western civilization in the Greek culture, they're able to connect it to what they've learned in history and what they've learned in Bible. And we're not getting those connections yet in the way that we need to keep all that data moving forward with the student. And that's a very important part of it. And that's something that I think we need to collectively keep ourselves aware of and pursue and discuss. And you may even have some comments that I would appreciate hearing there in knowing how you've succeeded in doing that also. But let's talk now about the practicality of the transition. I'm going to focus really in three categories, kind of an early category, a main category, and a late category, thinking that the transition is primarily a seventh grade phenomenon, so that's our main category, and then early, of course, would be the year before that, sixth, and the year after that would be the late category, eighth. So in the early category, we have comprehension exercises that we start to see changing a little bit. If you're familiar with some of the comprehension guides that we've published, you'll know a little bit what I'm talking about. If you have this outline, they've been passed out, right? Everybody has one. Look at the second page, the page right behind the outline. And this is Little House on the Prairie, which is a second or third grade book. Second grade book. Look at the questions. How long would Pa be gone? That's a number answer. Now, the kids have two lines there, and they're expected to write a full sentence, but it's just a fact. Whom did Jack treed? We have a typo there? Whom had Jack treed? Thank you. on top of the woodpile. Now I know what that is. Yeah, I do, actually. has to do with that lost year from 49 to 50. You know, it's a factual answer. The first night when the owls said, "Who?" And the wind cried mournfully, why did Laura and Mary think they were safe? Well, that's still, you know, why is a little bit different way of asking something, but still a factual answer that we're looking for. Now look at the next page. And this is a sixth grade book, Fahrenheit 451. And this, parenthetically, does raise a little bit of controversy. You have to understand, if you haven't read this book, it's written by a man who doesn't profess any faith and has some things in it that occasionally get us some disturbing mail, but we've gotten used to it, so we just give it to Jenny and she answers it. I'm just kidding. But now the questions have morphed a little bit, and we're starting to push the student. This is still sixth grade, but we're asking them to make some analytical decisions and give us some analytical answers. Why do you think reality TV programs are so good at attracting viewers? Okay. Now, we're trying to help have them understand in the context of Fahrenheit 451, and Fahrenheit 451 is a lot about television. It's a lot about television if you don't know the book. And so what we're trying to do is get them to think in these categories. It's not just about remembering. It's about connecting things and starting to reason them out. So we're starting to do that a little bit in sixth grade. There's not a lot of this. I believe this book is second semester, typically, so it's late in the year. But what we're trying to do is encourage that transition by causing them to have to answer fairly basic questions that are more than just recalling facts. So that's a natural way that we cause the transition. The other thing that we're starting to do is encourage some discussions that relate how and why. If you're familiar with our the Bible curriculum, in sixth grade they're dealing with everything in the New Testament after the Gospels, the epistles through Revelation. And so it's a natural thing for them to have some eschatological discussions and look at the four main categories of that and start to wrestle that down. So that becomes a place where they start to argue a little bit about what they believe and why they believe it. It's also an important thing to understand that really we're dealing with a series of questions. We have who, what, where, and when, which tend to be grammar, and how and why tend to be dialectic. Now, there are some exceptions to that. You know, three-year-olds do ask why. Seven-year-olds do ask why, but what they're really asking for is more information. But when a child at this age and beyond asks why, he's asking a very different question. He means something very different by the way he says why. And we want to recognize that. We want to encourage that. And so we're looking to bring that in to the teaching environment more and more. And then we move into what we are calling the main transition time frame, seventh grade. Now here, we've made the mistake of moving it hook, line, and sinker without keeping some connections. So we're looking to reach back and make some connections. And some of that is what I'm noting here, that we shouldn't expect sudden change, but we should lead the change. If you go from having done 1815 to the present in history, right into Omnibus One, without helping them transition there a little bit, you'll see that there are some things that are going to cause some trouble. And I may be using some terms, if you're not familiar with the curriculum, you may not completely understand. What I mean is, we're dealing with this grammar curriculum, it's dealing with 1815 to the present, primarily about American history. And then all of a sudden, we're jumping back to ancient Greece, ancient Rome, and Bible times, and reading great books, as opposed to more recently written books in many instances, and expecting them to comprehend them, expecting them to make the connections, and expecting them to be able to engage with them in an argumentative sort of way. Well, we need to realize that we need to lead them in that process, and there are some things that need to be done gradually. One of the ways that we do that, thank you. One of the ways that we do that is by reading out loud with them and stopping and discussing, but keeping in mind, not only do we want to make sure that they've comprehended what was read, but they've dealt with it thoughtfully. So we might spend some time. This is one of the things that we're working into the day at school, is significant periods of time of reading some of these more difficult works out loud, so that the teacher can see if they're getting it and interact with them with questions. And some of those questions, again, are about the content, some of them are about the reasoning, and you want to do that. But as you do that, the more you do that, you should expect that it doesn't need to be done indefinitely, and at some point you can start to lessen that. Now, I think there's always a time in that environment where there's some benefit about reading out loud. My wife and I read out loud to each other in some areas and find those very beneficial. So I'm not suggesting that we grow out of it entirely, but we do want to gradually increase their independence in their study. One of our goals is to get them to be able to read a book themselves and to come in then in class and discuss it with other students who have read it, assuming that they've all comprehended it, be able to assume that they've all comprehended it, and now they're ready to wrestle down the ideas. And so we want to work toward that point. That's our goal in the transition at the main there. We want to realize that history and reading activities are moving from chanting to discussion. If you're experienced in using what most people do in classical pedagogy, they're doing all kinds of creative things, and one of those things is chanting as a tool of memorization. But we're starting to phase that out a little bit, recognizing that the student is growing up. It's a little bit more of a younger child's way of doing things, and we want to treat them as children who are growing up. And With your oldest child in particular, you will be most tempted to retard that process. And I ask you to just be aware of it. Don't do that. It's more of a temptation for mothers than it is for fathers. Mothers are nurturing. Fathers are rough. So you want to be aware of that. And especially fathers who tend to be able to look at it, frankly, a little bit more objective because they're not as nurturing, to just encourage that process along. I mentioned already, because I got out of order, that questions of how and why replace the who, what's, where's, and when's kinds of things, because what we're doing is talking about more thought-provoking things than we are just data recitation. And there's a pattern, though, that I think is one that does tend to stick with us, and that's establishing a common knowledge base. And so it's not going to be an uncommon thing in the main of this transition to start with factual questions and to move into more dialectic and open-ended questions. And we want to think about that. So it's not an unusual thing to start to make sure that everybody's on the same page if you're dealing with more than one student, or to make sure that one student is with you and has gotten it. And so that's an important part of the process, establishing a common starting point. That's more important in a group environment like a school or a co-op of some sort, a university model, because you're dealing with multiple kids. And I can tell you, even a group of four, one child will find a way to duck. And so you want to make sure as teachers that you don't let that happen. You're about helping every one of them. You don't want to just have the group ability rise. You want to have each individual student's ability rise. And then we move on to this later category. I mentioned earlier that we never really finish with the process of learning that we call the grammar stage. Med school has an aspect to it, as I noted earlier, and that's substantially what I want to note here. Realize that all new content has a grammar aspect to it. So it doesn't matter what we're doing. If we're plowing into a new area, we've got a grammar aspect that's going to be the beginning of it. But there is a necessity to respect the changing nature of the learner and not just because it's grammar stuff, treat them like it's a second grader. And you want to recognize the audience. In John Milton Gregory's book, The Seven Laws of Teaching, he talks about really understanding the learner and meeting the learner where they are. And a talented teacher understands that, if not objectively, intuitively. And so you want to make sure that you really meet the student where they are and not... go beneath them and do something that's belittling them. It will not prove beneficial in the long run. And then I think, again, it's important to frequently refer back to the grammar foundation. Again, I'm repeating myself a little bit for emphasis because I really think that this is an important part of that process. Maintaining a balance between too much grammar and too little grammar at this point in the game is a very important thing. But it is crucial to note history and Bible facts. We had an interesting thing happen yesterday over at Carnegie Mellon. We were walking through the music building, and there are a number of... It's a fabulous building, by the way. Every classical Christian school should have a building that looks like that. If you have seen it, you know what I mean. It's a very expensive building, has wonderful statues, and one of them I pointed out to one of my sons, and I said, tell me when he lived. And he was only off by about 800 years. So frankly, what it was a reflection on a failure of ours to really keep him current in some of that. Thankfully, his brother, we only have two of them with us this week, and I'm not going to tell you which was which, but his brother was able to say, no, he was then, and nailed it exactly. But those are the kinds of things that need to be reviewed, because we don't remember everything we've memorized if we don't stay after it. And we're still in the process of figuring out the best ways to do that. The history and Bible chants that we do and the music, it seems entirely inappropriate for an eighth grader and beyond, but we need something that will help us do that, and we're still trying to wrestle that down in our own environment, but the point is it really is important to have some aspects of review there in the process. And then the other thing is applying the leverage of Latin. Look for opportunities to make those kinds of connections also, to keep them thinking about the benefit that Latin has been to them, to motivate them on their own. Look for words that they may not be familiar with and help them tear them apart with the Latin roots that they recall. There are an enormous amount of them committed to memory for a student that's had a couple years of Latin. Review of that and looking for those opportunities will prove tremendous benefit for the student, not only learning that word, but understanding the importance of staying current there. And doing that is a very important part of the process. And now that implies something also. That implies that the eighth grade teacher who's teaching history, literature, or theology, or who knows what, has a little bit of a background in Latin. And that's an important ingredient, and I think will become increasingly important. I had the pleasure of going to the Mars Hill accreditation visit for ACCS. Mars Hill is a school in Cincinnati, not all that far from some of you, I don't suppose. And I got a chance to observe their Latin teacher doing a little bit of teaching math in Latin. Now, that is the kind of thing that I think we will see happen more and more. I used to, and it was only about 5, maybe 7 years ago, think that it was entirely unrealistic to teach a whole history class in Latin or a literature class in Latin. And I also thought that it was probably not all that important. I'm changing in my thinking there, and I think that it's not only possible to do in relatively short order, 10 years, but think that it's of incredible importance, and I think we'll see that in our lifetime, and we'll see. I'm not thinking that it's more important than a whole lot of other things, but I do think that it's an important way to leverage the learning process in a very beneficial way. A couple general considerations. A question of whether or not you want to force change or wait on change. And I know if you're a typical student like I am sometimes, you want an answer that you can run with. You don't want to have to think about it. Sorry, you're no longer grammar students. You have to think about it. And the point is, you have to apply wisdom. There are times where you have to force kids to move on. There are times when you have to wait on them to move on. And you have to know what the time is that you're faced with. I would say, generally speaking, we tend to undershoot, and so I would encourage you to approach things from that standpoint, that you're going to be more inclined to think that it's time to wait than it is time to force change. And that's the nature of leadership. Leadership tends to pull rather than push, and so pulling them along rather than coming up from behind is kind of the way I would encourage you to think about it. You want to set standards and expectations. Now we get into a little thing that's actually really a sidebar, but related, and that's the idea of letting boys be boys. I've made an observation, and this is true, I think, more so in the Christian community than anywhere else, and that is the best-behaved boy is a girl. What I mean by that is, we kind of expect boys and girls to behave the same way and to do things the same way, and I can assure you they won't and they shouldn't. And I don't mean that that means that the boy should dip the pigtails of the girl in front of him in the proverbial inkwell and do those kinds of things that we heard about from our grandparents. But what I do mean is that they're going to behave very differently. And wrestling and fighting among boys isn't always a bad thing. And that goes for verbal wrestling and fighting also. And that's part of the process. It needs to be disciplined. It needs to be understood. It need not be sinful in order to be that way. But that's a hard thing for many people today. And again, most notably, mothers. So beware of that, fathers. Beware of that, mothers. And recognize that. That's a little bit why I was saying in the last talk, again, a little bit tongue-in-cheek there, and yet with some meaning, that there's an element that my wife doesn't understand about our boys. Well, that's why I'm there. I'm supposed to help her understand that, and I'm supposed to deal with that. By the grace of God, I haven't had to figure out young girls yet. And I don't know what we'd have done if I'd had a young girl, especially after having three boys. We would have really been faced with an interesting challenge. I look forward to having daughters-in-law and granddaughters so I can have the best of both worlds. That is, I can have them when I want them and get rid of them when I don't. That's also true of my sons at a certain level, too. But the point is, the boys and girls are different, and we need to recognize that, and there's probably no more significant place for that difference than right here in this transition, and you want to be aware of that. I'll also say parenthetically, because we have a little bit of time, my wife has actually grown accustomed to going to the emergency room. Our 15-year-old, before he was five, had 140 stitches in six visits. We got to the point where we just called, most of them happened on Saturdays too, and we just called a plastic surgeon, meet him in the office, and we would be the ones assisting him. He wouldn't even call a nurse in. It got to be that kind of regular thing. I'm not encouraging that. I hope you won't report us to the state, but I will say that you need to recognize that that's not the way we would hope that our young girls would have experienced that stage, but we really didn't care a whole lot that it happened with boys. And finally, in conclusion, realize that this transition doesn't just happen. They do change their nature, but the educational process then needs to be teacher-led. So you're going to be in a place where you're going to have to cause them to start thinking well in the categories that they tend to want to think in. They're going to want to argue. Teach them to argue well. And finally, don't forget, just because they've left this wonderful childhood stage to go in this awesome and awful temporary stage, that you're still dealing with children and not young adults. And that's an important thing to realize, too. They're not ready for everything. Some of what they argue about, they really don't know what they're talking about. They may not listen to you if you tell them that they don't know what they're talking about, so be a wise teacher in that process also. Now, I'm going to ask Laurie to join me here, and you can address questions to either of us. She is really, if you don't know her, I am constantly amazed. She doesn't spend a lot of time at the office, but I'll get a call every now and then from a customer that asks me about a specific curriculum in grammar school, most notably. And there's never been an instance where I've come home and said, what can you tell me about this, that she hasn't been familiar with it. She really is an incredible knowledge bank when it comes to understanding these educational tools that we're used to. So please feel free to ask either of us any question on the point. I will repeat the questions as they're asked. Yes. The question is, are there touch points to realize their readiness for change from the grammar stage to the dialectic stage? Yes. They start to argue about things they didn't previously argue about. They tend to just get a little bit more difficult. What would you say in terms of academic categories also, or maybe broader than that?
Well, generally, I think that you just see a change to where they're not... to where they're just not interested in it. You know, that happens a lot with the chanting. I'll have parents call me all the time. I don't understand. This year we're doing whatever. And my child, you know, we used to get in the car. I always tell people the best time, particularly if you're a homeschooler, the best time to learn your memorization stuff is throw tape in the car. How many hours do we all moms spend driving around in the car? And, you know, they used to love to do this. It's getting to be really difficult. They don't like doing this anymore, particularly boys. I mean, by fifth grade, most boys just are no longer interested. The other kind of, I used to not say this, but puberty, it really is. It's a touch mark. We see it at school all the time. I'll have parents come in and I'll ask a question, and sure enough, that's one of those things physically we see with children where there's just a huge change. But, realize that one of the freedoms you have as homeschoolers that in a school situation you don't have is you can really make a change then. Start having them memorize things by memorizing sheets of information versus chanting. If you're in a school situation, what we found works best is we use them as leaders. We do something called memory period at our school. The first 25 minutes of the day, second through sixth grade, is all in one room, and they're going through everything we memorize all year long. It's on a rotating basis, and they just are all together. And it's a great and fun time. But it inevitably, our sixth graders are not interested, and particularly by after Christmas, they are really not interested. So what we've done is we use them as the leaders. Well, they're happy to teach the younger children. That's great, and it's a great transition for them.
The question is, go ahead. And if that's your question.
Well, I was thinking about the touch points, and one way to see a child moving out of concrete into abstract thinking, which we're talking grammar and dialectic, is to see how they're thinking. And one way to do that is to teach them what words mean. What does decide mean? What does evaluate mean? And then that's a fact. They learn that. And then you can begin to see them evaluating and deciding as they're moving into that.
Yeah, one of the things that we need to realize, the question was, have we ever thought about developing a curriculum that teaches critical thinking? Critical thinking has become this vogue kind of word in education. I, took my education courses a really long time ago, over 20 years ago. And anyway, by the end of my education, I was starting to hear those kind of words. And one of the things we need to realize is Latin was that. Latin was the subject and the discipline that taught critical thinking to children. And I think that's what we need to use as a tool. I mean, there are a lot of excellent, tools out there that can be used to teach critical thinking, but there are only so many hours in a day. You have those opportunities to do that with literature and some things like that, but using Latin as that tool is just a wonderful way to do that.
Hold on just a second. Furthering that, that's an aspect, and I understand why you don't buy it, because there are elements of appreciation that we're still in the process of recovering. And I think Laurie would admit that we're only barely seeing that. By faith, we've understood that that's the way it was, but we're only seeing it a little bit in terms of our own appreciation. I do think also that as the classical Christian education process matures, that we'll see increasing needs for heightened, let me say this a little differently, that we'll see a continual need for increasing the quality of materials and the pace of materials and the depth of materials. We've seen that in Latin curricula. We've seen that in a lot of different things. And what's needed, or what was needed in the 90s, when we're all at ground zero trying to build up, is going to be very different than what we might experience in 2015 with the same age kid if we continue to be faithful in this process. This is a way to illustrate that is by imagining a school when it starts its first year and it's going to open up kindergarten through sixth grade. What are those sixth graders are going to be able to do this year compared to sixth graders who started in that school as kindergartners 6 years later? I can't tell you how big that difference is. Okay. If you're suggesting that the age at which they'll be ready for the dialectic stage is going to get younger, I would argue that that's not the case because it's a physiological and psychological thing. It's not ability or curriculum, but rather the nature of how we've been created. Does that address it? Well, maybe we can try a little bit afterward, too. Valerie, did you have a question?
I did. I have a bunch of boys, too. We're working on this omnibus thing. And interestingly, my son said the other day, girls at this stage are smarter than boys. But we are stronger than them. And I said, correction, some girls are smarter than some boys right. at this stage. And some boys are stronger. No, Mom. Well, whatever. How do you take these reading works we're trying to get these boys who are full of to read? And I know part of it is the winsomeness of the teacher and the encouragement from home. But we are dealing with a physiological construct here. It's
a swift stick.
Well, there is a disciplinary aspect. The question, if I understand it, is how do we get kids to want to do some of the stuff that they don't want to do?
And I would say, because we aren't able to discuss in this venue, that there are differences in sex, that it will be most the boys that I'm discussing.
Absolutely.
Sure.
And that's my
question. Sure.
And
right.
And now, seventh grade, we're doing classical education. We didn't do any chanting. You know, we didn't do any of that.
But there are all kinds of transitions that we have to deal with coming from, you know, we're still picking up momentum. When you're sitting still, it's hard to go in a direction. Now we're getting a little speed, but there are still all kinds of things. Somebody coming in to classical education at seventh grade is enormously different in what they're interested in, capable of, and ready for when they're in seventh grade. You have those kinds of things to contend with. You also have interests to contend with. My wife and I adopted the philosophy in child rearing of greasing the skids of the interests of our kids. What I mean by that is, if we found that they had an interest or ability, we would encourage that in the direction they wanted to go, as opposed to everybody doing the same thing. Okay? Now, you heard from Dave earlier that I play a lot of golf. I only have one son that plays a lot of golf. I have another one that's actually very good but doesn't have much interest in it, and two other ones who aren't interested and aren't any good. But they're all very good at the things that they're interested in and are doing phenomenal things in very different categories. My oldest one is working on a PhD in nanotechnology, actually in materials engineering, and he's going straight through bachelor's to PhD in 6 years in a program. My next one is planning to go to college next year on a golf scholarship. My third one is interested in musical theater, and my fourth one has his own business on a website already, and he's 15. How could you be any different than that? And it's because we've just kind of greased the skids. And when you deal with that kind of thing, you're dealing with kids of varying interests. But it is incumbent on the teacher to know the student, to try and capture their interest where it is and connect them with with something in their life to the work that they're going to be doing. And there are any number of ways to do that, but there are enormous challenges in doing that also.
Yeah, I would just say, and I said a swift stick, only because, you know, we have four children. Our oldest one would have read any of these works. It was absolutely easy for him. He understood it the first time. In seventh grade, he was translating, in Latin. I mean, he was able to read some of the works in Latin, actually. Our next one is an athlete, and he's a very diligent and dutiful child, so he did it because he was told to. Our third one would read Shakespeare all day long, but not really real interested in anything else, and so you had to find a hook for him. The hook for him was anything that was a play, As long as the teacher acted it out, life is a theater. Life is a stage. He's great. And our fourth one is not interested in this. I have done everything identical to the way I did it with three other children. I know I have. I used to question myself, but we have. And he does his work for one reason, because he knows what the consequences with this man are if he doesn't do the work. And I think as mothers, particularly, it's very easy. Oh, they're just not getting it. And my background's special education. So there are children who don't, that really are going to struggle. And that's true. But take that out of the picture, because that's not the majority of children. You really have to just say you're going to do this. Dad goes to the office every day. That's his job. This is where God has called you, and it's your job right now to do this. Now, at the same time I say that, we've got to make it interesting for them and as interesting as we can. So he told you he has a business. One of his teachers this year kind of made a game for him to try to have him figure out the economics in books. Well, that was rather interesting to him, to kind of see if there was anything in the ancient, you know, or in the medieval world that he could bring about for that. So finding, you know, what the child's interests are. But sometimes it really does just boil down to, you know, we're going to sit down and we're going to read this material. And reading out loud, I think, is critical, particularly if you're going to start reading, you know, right off the bat, Livy and Herodotus and Thucydides and Aeschylus. I mean, these are difficult works, but they're fun. I mean, Herodotus is just the most, I love that book. I mean, when we did the omnibus, and I'd read Herodotus before, but you guys, what a great movie it would be. I mean, there's, you know, all these incredible things going on, and if you can just capture them, get past the language. But if we don't start somewhere, they're always going to be difficult. I don't care if you wait till they're 16. They are going to be difficult whenever you start, because it's so far outside of where we are today. They're inundated with things that come easily. We want McDonald's. We want drive-through mentality. And this kind of education is not a drive-through mentality. It's not going to come in 15 minutes. Yes.
I would not. The question is, with regard to some of the study, it is so much, and sometimes children are overwhelmed. That's where I come back to the point of forcing change or waiting on change. It's the same kind of thing. You know, how much is enough and how much is too much? We need to learn, we need to read our children, but we don't necessarily need to take their cues entirely. We're the teacher, they're the student, and part of the teaching process is knowing when something is too much. Yeah, with regard to materials that we've created, I can tell you at Veritas Academy, we don't do everything in the book. Some things get skipped. Okay, some things get skipped. But our inclination today is not to do too much. Our inclination is to do too little. There are people that are probably here that are inclined to do too much. But most of you are inclined to do too little. I'm talking to you as a group. I'm telling you to be wise. And I'm telling you that your kids can do more than you think they can. But there is some such a thing as too much. How do you measure that? They're your kids. They're not mine. You figure it out. Yeah.
Latin, a need for somebody who had that type of background.
Sure. Well, there are a couple questions in there. Let me isolate the first one, and that is, how do you teach something that you haven't learned? And that's an enormous difficulty. But let's look. The one thing we can be certain of, the alternative of not teaching it, is a bad idea. We're here because that we know that. Okay. You got up early today. You came out on a Saturday morning when it was cold and, you know, it might snow today. And you did that because you think that getting this kind of education for your children is a good thing, even though you didn't have it for yourself. So now we're committed to getting something for them that we didn't get for ourselves. Some of us are trying to do it ourselves, which creates an interesting dilemma. And many of the curriculum providers, Veritas Press as well as Canon Press and Logos and Jay Weil's business with the science, are all aware of those kinds of things and are trying to do something about it. But then the question of how do we do some of those things that seem so far-fetched is the answer is if you can't do it, you can't do it. I couldn't teach history in Latin. I didn't study Latin. I've learned a little bit of Latin by being the parent of four boys that have taken a lot of Latin and interacted with it a lot. But they're the ones that are more likely to be able to do that kind of thing. And so we do what we can with what we've got, realizing that there are things that we can do about it to make us more apt to teach. We also use tools where other people have done those things. Blackburn is doing that. They're saying our constituents want to homeschool, but they can't do everything that they want to do. We can help them do that. So they do a two-day-a-week thing where they're doing some of the more difficult things on those 2 days to make the rest of it possible at home. And then there's another aspect, and this is an aspect that is particularly difficult in a recovery period like ours, and that is to recognize that it's a whole lot more work to recover than it is to maintain. Okay? And so we are faced with more a disproportionate amount of work presently. There was another question at the end, though, that I'm forgetting now. If you can rephrase that, I'll get after that. Tools for evaluation. The question is, how can we evaluate whether or not we're doing all we can and doing it well? There are a lot of people in your immediate area that probably have some idea of what's going on. Another homeschool family, I don't know your circumstances, assuming you're homeschooling from what you said, getting with another homeschool family is doing the same kind of thing. Wrestle ideas back and forth. There are businesses like ours who you can call and say, here's what we're doing, how are we doing? What would you recommend to take it up another notch? But always be looking for ways, when you can, to notch it up a little bit, like training for a marathon. If you can't run, you don't go out and run 15 miles the first day of training. You work up to it. And there is an element of that that's a part of it, too. In the back there. That's very good feedback. I have a very... She didn't ask a question, so I'll not repeat the question, but the comment that she made, which you heard, and I just want to repeat for the tape, was that there are some other things that we need to consider about this, and we need to look at it. We're not just trying to raise children to be teachers or to be academic wonks, you know that are going to go around and do things. And I have a very different perspective on classical education today, having had kids go through the system, kids of my own, than I did when I started. And I think that's a very important thing. What does it look like for a classically educated kid to be a businessman? What does it look like for a classically educated kid to do research in nanotechnology?
And those things are answerable, and they're important that we have some understanding on them, because it means that what we're not trying to do is just get it so that every kid can read Virgil in Latin at night, at home, by themselves, and enjoy it. Yes, you. The question is, what does math look like in the transition? Generally speaking, we tend to think that algebra is the beginning of the dialectic for math. So if you're familiar with what our recommendations are, you know that we think of Algebra 1 half as a sixth grade curriculum and Algebra 1 as a seventh grade curriculum in the Saxon vernacular. The terminology that they use. Algebra 1 half is a Saxon term, which is a book that is kind of starting to spoon feed them and encourage them into algebra. So it's really a transitioning book, and that's the way we think of it. Algebra has a lot more reasoning going on than simply, you know, doing a long division problem or a long multiplication problem. So that's one of the major transition points that we see. But it's a gentle process. Geometry is in eighth grade, but there are things like geometry that would naturally tie into the study of formal logic, too. It's the same kind of thing. And what geometry really is practiced formal logic. In the back.
When do you start Latin?
We start Latin in second grade, very gently, using the Memoria Press, Prima Latina. And I think that... that what they've done is done some real wonderful things and go into what I might call a second generation look at Latin and grammar school. But I expect that there will be additional things that need to happen and can happen as parents become more familiar, as older students are there and younger students are around those older students in a family and that sort of thing. So like I said in my first talk, we continue to look for opportunities to raise the bar. Not to make it so that it hurts your legs to jump it, but to realize that we're trying to keep the same tension on the learning process, because students are getting more, should theoretically become more capable, because in the recovery process we're improving the recovery.
But this is what you have to realize. Just because they're doing more reading at a certain level doesn't mean they're going to hit the transition level there. In other words, it doesn't mean that their thinking is dialectic in nature. We have children come into kindergarten that are reading, I'm not exaggerating, at a fifth and sixth grade level. That doesn't mean that that child is able to, do logic. And I have parents call me all the time, oh, my child is so far ahead, you know, they're doing this, and I think I need to start logic. How old's your child? 8. No, you really don't need to start logic. And so what you need to do is go sideways when you have a child like that. Go ahead.
I understand what you're saying, but the natural progression of the curriculum that's out there means that she's going to be hitting those transitional materials.
That's what I'm talking about.
Instead of trying to hurry through the material, so for instance, I'm assuming that you're, are you talking about math, for instance? I mean, our regular math at our school in first grade is Saxon 2, okay? So that's just the norm. And what we do with children in, say, in first grade that are really advanced is I have them read extra books and start writing book reports. Because their writing skills, no matter how well they're reading, their writing skills do not keep up with their reading skills, generally speaking. So we have them start writing a whole lot more. When they get a little bit older in history, I start doing things like math puzzles with them and some things like that that are just different. And are you saying, where is that material? Is that one of your... Right. Okay.
Well, there are instances where I would say that that's appropriate.
Yeah.
Also.
Our oldest son.
Math would be a little different. I answered the question earlier suggesting that Algebra 1 was really the most akin to the first year of dialectic. But I don't want you to think, again, keep in mind we're talking about wisdom, we're talking about application. And with regard to math, it's not as much a dialectic activity. Algebra 1 is not as dialectic as formal and informal logic is. So I could see the possibility of Algebra 1 going to that level. I think that happened with our oldest one.
But I will say, I do see a lot of children that start like where your child is, and then they hit this plateau, and they don't keep going. That is something that I do see quite a bit, because the early material is very easy, and so they get through it, particularly if they have older siblings. I just see a lot of children that hit that fourth grade level year, and it really plateaus out because things really do shift up at that point.
That's an excellent point. The question is, what if you have a student who's mastered the material that you've expected to be at a certain grade level, and you don't want to move beyond the grammar stage too quickly? Are there other things that we could bring into grammar school that we haven't? And memorizing the periodic table would be an excellent thing to do, because it's something that's a good thing for somebody to have memorized. That doesn't tend to be a grammar school exercise, but the time might be available to do it. Yes. Okay. Well, the first question you're asking is, what do you do to transition? But those are the kinds of things. Do you have a copy of the outline?
When you come to a text, it's you and the text and the child.
Right. But
you need to get tools.
You need those tools, and you need to do it. And that's one of the things we were trying to do with the Omnibus book. That's one of the things we try to do with the comprehension guides. But creating opportunity, young son or daughter?
Daughter.
Okay. Does she help you in dinner preparation? What a wonderful opportunity to start and have discussions. While you're doing something, you can always talk. I have yet to meet anybody.
But she hasn't read the books.
Well, but even if you haven't read the book, there are ways to ask questions that get the student talking and thinking about things that you haven't read.
He's really good at that.
And that's because in high school I learned to fake it. You don't get to be good about talking about a book you haven't read without having practiced it. But that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Learn to ask questions. Well, tell me something you've read recently that you doubt I've read. Okay? I haven't read Atom of the Road.
It's medieval.
I know that. I know about it, which is really important, knowing about it. What was Adam do? What was the main line of the story for Adam of the Road? Okay, Adam was the son of a minstrel. What kind of adventures did he get involved in as the son of a minstrel? I'm establishing some grammar understanding that's common between you and me. Okay, that's my first step. Now let me quit the questions and jump to the principle, because I got to stop. Because then what I'm going to do is, was Adam a godly kid? Why do you make that judgment? What might you have done differently had you been in his situation? How do you think Adam's parents thought of him? All this, again, if I remember correctly, Adam didn't have both his parents. I'm not sure about that, but I think there's some things. And so what you're moving into analytical questions. Okay, we need to stop here. You had a second question. If you want to come up here, I'll be happy to answer it. Thank you very much.